We have a number of questions already, so we'll quickly move on so that we have time to cover them. So I'll ask the first one, and then we'll go from there. Is there a difference between standards and tradition? And if not, should one influence the other? That is the question.
Well, I'm not certain that I understand exactly what all is couched in that question. Taking it at face value, I would have to say for myself, and this is Joe's opinion now, that there is a difference, or that there could be a difference. And I really think that we perceive there being some difference in traditions versus standards. It would seem to me that traditions would be those forms of things that that's the way we've done it. You know, and then it has worked through the years, and we've just continued to do that, not even knowing for sure where that started. In my cabinet shop, there's the way that I do certain things that someone coming in may say, why do you do that like that? And sometimes I would know, and sometimes I'm not sure that I could recollect exactly where that came from, but it's a tradition. It's just the way I've always done it. And yes, many times I feel pretty strongly about it. If someone would come in as an employee and say, well, I don't think you should do it that way, I think you should do it this way, I would be suspect of his loyalty as a, an employee. Because this is the way I've always done it, and it proved itself to be acceptable. To me, that's a tradition, and you can impose that on the church and the spiritual community as well. A standard would be something that we as a group would decide, okay, we're having a problem with whatever, and collectively agree this is becoming a real problem. And so we need to decide what we're going to do about it. And so the Brotherhood meets together, and some kind of cohesive decision is made, and then we agree, okay, heretofore we haven't done it this way, but now we're going to. To me, that would be a standard, whether it's written, whether it's just verbal, whether it's something, a conscious awareness and decision is not the issue at all. But that would, to me, be a standard. Does one influence the other? I would say absolutely. I think that our standards do impinge upon our traditions, but I think the other way is probably even stronger. I believe that how we view traditions, good, solid traditions, not just loose or fluffy, wishful thinking type things, but good solid traditions do have some effect on how we would view a standard. Let me give you this example. Let's say that you have a tradition that the kind of car that you own or drive would have subdued colors. It's not written that thou shalt not have a bright red car or a yellow car or whatever. And I didn't go out here to look at what color the cars are. That's not my point at all. But my point is that traditionally this group, whatever group it is, has understood that out of respect and a desire to be subdued in our lifestyle, we would avoid certain things. It's doubtful that you would ever need, if you embrace that tradition as legitimate and respectfully, it's doubtful that you ever need to make a standard in reference to that, because the tradition that you've had has directed by its very spirit the concept of separation in that area. And so, yes, they do certainly influence each other.
Yeah, I think Joe and I are, you know, one mind on this. It was helpful. We got the question, you know, at the beginning of today so we could think about it and talk about it. And of course those terms could be used in different ways by different people, but that's how I would think of it, a tradition, something that's been around a long time, not necessarily something a congregation specifically decides on. And, yeah, I don't know where you all are at. I know where I was at as a young man, but I did not grow up in plain circles, but, I used to think traditions were really stupid, you know. I remember the first time I met a conservative Anabaptist, this would have been Beachy's. I remember telling my wife, I wonder if they realize how stupid they look, you know, and I was, you know, fairly worldly at that point, you know, a good fundamentalist, who loved the world. Yeah, I didn't get it. I mean, it just seemed like, yeah, that these people are just, you know, they're just doing things for dumb reasons and stuff like that. And it took me a long time to finally understand it all. And that's just my own fault and attitudes, which a lot of seekers have, but, beyond standards, you know, there's a whole culture, a whole way of life that our conservative Anabaptist churches embrace, and it is a good thing. I used to feel the opposite, but what changed my mind was trying to do something different, you know. Where we lived in Texas, there weren't any plain churches, so we had to kind of create it from scratch, and wow, did I find out how hard that is when you don't have patterns that people have followed and everybody's got their own idea and all of that. And it's why most seeker churches, most of the remnant churches, usually disband within 5 years. And it's not the fault of charity or anything like that. It is just very hard for people who don't have a particular tradition and you're trying to create ones from scratch. So view it as a treasure. What you have. It may seem annoying at times, and there may be things that, yeah, this doesn't have to be, but it's a precious thing that I guarantee you, if you had to recreate it from scratch, you would probably find it almost impossible to do that. And many traditions, some would go back to the beginning of the Anabaptists, some actually go back to the early church, and you don't know why you're necessarily doing it other than it's traditional, like segregated seating, you know, brothers on one side, sisters on the other. There's nothing in the New Testament that commands that, but that's how the early church did it. It's been a Christian practice, probably handed down by the apostles. I feel quite certain it was, but that's what all of the churches did. Wearing a head covering all the time. 1 Corinthians 11, you know, the specific command is when you're praying or prophesying. But again, the early church mentions that the sisters wear it all the time, and that's why we do that. It was something handed down. It's not Anabaptist. It's something from, you know, way back at the very beginning. And like I say, those things are precious that you lose them, you know, very hard. It is very hard to come back with them. Where standards, yeah, they may be something fairly recent that has to deal with, like there's no tradition on internet or cell phones or something like that because they are fairly new. And so each church has to, you know, make decisions of, is this something good? Is it bad? Is it harmful? That kind of thing. Okay.
Okay. All right. Next question, it was directed to David, but they both can. Should a Christian buy or sell on Sunday?
Yeah, there would be divided opinions on that, I'm pretty sure. My first answer would be whatever the standard of your church says, you know, then you need to follow that. That's certainly the first answer. If your church allows it, but it goes against your conscience, then don't do it. That's for sure. Probably most of us wouldn't have any reason to sell. You might have one to, you know, to buy. You may be traveling, want to eat out at a restaurant or something like that. The scripture that came to my mind was Romans 14. If you want to turn there, Romans 14, 4 through 6. Romans 14:4-6, it says, "Who are you to judge another servant? To his own master he stands or falls. Indeed, he will be made to stand, for God is able to make him stand. One person esteems one day above another. Another esteems every day alike. Let each be fully convinced in his own mind. He who observes the day observes it to the Lord, and he who does not observe the day, to the Lord he does not observe it. He who eats, eats to the Lord, for he gives God thanks, and he who does not eat, to the Lord he does not eat and gives God thanks. For none of us lives to himself, and no one dies to himself." I can say, you know, the early Christians did not view Sunday as the Sabbath. The Sabbath is Saturday. It always was, and there's nothing in the New Testament that says it was switched to Sunday. Sunday is the day Christians met for worship, but at that time in the Roman Empire, that was not a holiday. It was a work day, the first day of the week. It didn't become a holiday until Constantine embraced Christianity, or at least wanted to help Christianity, and so he made it a holiday, which would make it easy for Christians to go to worship services, because that day was a day off. Now, having said that, some Christians felt if they did not have to work, that it was commendable to use the Lord's Day as a day for prayer and that sort of thing. Tertullian talks about that. I think God does know that in our makeup, we need a day of rest every week. And so there is a good thing of taking Sunday as a day of rest and a day of worship. I used to be very opposed to it because I felt like people were still following the law when the law has been done away with. But I do see a natural law there that having a day of rest is something good and beneficial. But I think we need to be careful if we're judging others and saying they're sinning because they do that. Because I don't think you can find, I know you can't find a verse in the New Testament that says you can't do this or that on Sunday. On the other hand, we should respect one another's conscience. And as he says, if a person keeps that day as a special day, then that's between them and God, and we should respect that and the other way around. But as I said, the first thing is, what is your church? Your church probably has a standard on that, and you should then respect what your church says on it. And then as long as you're complying with your church, then you need to follow what your conscience would say beyond that.
Most of you, if not all of you, have probably noticed that, and Brother David just took a drink, and that's fine, that I don't drink when I'm in the pulpit, water or anything else. But because he has a throat problem that he's dealing with right now, I respect that. I am not offended by that. But early in my ministry, I purposed that unless I have a cough or a cold or a sore throat or something, I am not going to take a drink in front of children in public. And my reason is that it makes children thirsty. You may argue that point, but I'm telling you that it's a fact. It makes them thirsty. So, is it wrong for him to take a drink now? Absolutely not. Would it be wrong for me to take a drink? I don't think so. But I've chosen, if I don't need to avoid that. I'm not blowing my horn. I'm just simply telling you how it is. My point is that there is an issue of restraint that I think every one of us needs to manifest and to demonstrate. And so, on the Lord's Day and the Sabbath, or whatever you choose to call it, the potential is that someone could and may misunderstand what you're doing on both sides, Christian and non-Christian. Allow me to explain. I have a cabinet shop. All of you know that. There are some customers that will call on Sunday. The phone that I have in the house is the phone that rings in the shop. I do not have a separate number. So a non-Christian calls about a kitchen, and I just listened to what Brother David said about having money to give to the poor. And so I don't want to lose the opportunity to get money to give to the poor, do I? Because I just heard what he said, and it was right. So that could be my logic. Well, okay, even though it's the Lord's Day, here's an opportunity for me to earn some money to give to the poor, so it should be a good thing. Well, really, that has nothing to do with what I choose there. I should say it has very little to do with it in reference to an unbeliever. Primarily, an unbeliever may not understand and probably does not understand why I don't work on Sunday, why I don't have my cabinet shop open. But to tell him, look, you call me back tomorrow or forget it, is non-Christian as well. And so what do I do? What do I need to do? And so there are times that I've said to people, depends somewhat on whether I know them at all, look, here's my schedule. I'll take a look at it at the beginning of the week, and I'll call you back with whether I can do something. I don't have my business open on Sunday. It's my day of rest. And while I respect you calling today because it's the only time that you can call, I would prefer that we do it this way. And I've never had someone who said, well, in that case, I'll go to someone else. Now, maybe someone has that I don't know of, but I doubt it. And so it's an opportunity to relate to someone without appearing critical or scolding, and yet you can share your position. Now, if someone calls me and says, look, I want you to build these cabinets, but it has to be installed next Sunday afternoon, or I'm going to get someone else to do it, I would say, that's okay, you get someone else to do it. And so, for myself, I cannot say that there is a cut and dried. I certainly do not believe that it would be the right thing for me to do to look, okay, the caller ID. Well, I don't know who's calling today. Let it ring. Now, some salesmen I'd like to do that with, but I try to be respectful. But I think unnecessary purchasing, things that we could have well done the day before, we ought to do the day before. Have I ever bought gas on Sunday? Yes, I have. There are times that I'm driving or traveling that I have gotten gas on Sunday. There was a time when I would not have done that. But the reason I would not have done it, because it would have been misunderstood by certain people. And I do not believe that we ought to deliberately do things that are an offense. We can forego certain things, can we not? As mature people, we can forego some things for the moment. Whether it's, I am so thirsty, I really have to get to a water fountain. You'll last 5 more minutes, usually, or whatever it may be. But I think we ought to be respectful of others and certainly embrace the principle of the word. There was a certain congregation in Sevierville, Tennessee, non-Mennonite, another denomination altogether, but that's essentially beside the point, was a big church. And we went there for a few things of special interest. And their audience would hold over 1,000. And so it was a big congregation. When the amen is over on Sunday, I timed it in 2 different occasions, 2 minutes. It was vacant, 2 minutes. You know where they were going? To be the first to get to their favorite restaurant before someone else got there. Were they there to discuss the sermon that they heard? I doubt it. You be the judge. And so, is it right to buy and sell on Sunday? I believe if we apply the principle of that being a day of rest, there's a lot of things that we would say, that I don't need to do today. I can forego that for my own conscience or for the sake of someone else.
Yeah, I would probably just add, I do view it as a tradition, one that's, I think, a good one that I grew up in the ones my age. You all, none of you would have been alive during this. We used to have what were called blue laws. And like in Texas, you could not sell most things on Sunday. Gas, you could, although most gas stations were closed, but all the other stores had to close. And Yeah, I'd be fine if those came back. They're not going to, you know, absent a miracle, but I think it was good for people to be forced to have a day of rest and that many feel like, well, you know, when businesses are open, then Christians are forced to work. Well, Christians should take a stand, and even the Supreme Court has said that a business has to accommodate you if it can reasonably do so. And, you know, I'm ashamed of Christians who would work on Sunday, either missing church or just working in general against their own conviction. We should realize at the same time, we're not following what the Old Testament says on the Sabbath. Because most Mennonites I know cook on Sunday, and that is work. That is something you could not do under the Sabbath. You could not kindle a fire on the Sabbath day. Orthodox Jews who keep the Sabbath, they will milk their cows on Sunday, but they will not use that milk. They will not sell it because that's working on the Sabbath. They will milk the cow for the good of the cow because the cow could develop an infection if it's not milked. But like I say, Mennonites, you know, a lot of dairy farmers, there's a lot of Mennonite dairy farmers, and they work on Sunday doing that. So, I mean, we should recognize before, you know, and not get too self-righteous that we're not following the laws of the Sabbath. But we're following, I think, a good tradition, and you know, I'm in favor of, I would not like to see us have our businesses open or to be, you know, that be a general day of trade on Sunday.
Okay, yeah, I don't know about you all, but I just really happy for a day that I can just kick back, I guess, however you want to say that, and don't have to feel guilty about being out there having to make some more money or pay my bills. That just feels pretty good to me. All right. This next question changes the subject totally. And us older brothers up here weren't quite sure what was meant by the question. We did get a little bit of help as to what it possibly might mean. I'll ask the question. What do you think of pre-dating? I don't know if that means that you like this girl or like this boy, and you're too young to officially date, I guess. And so, but everybody knows that, you know, you're going to probably get together and eventually be dating. I don't know if that's what it refers to. I thought about the fact that some fathers expect the boy to date them before they can date their daughter or whatever, something like that. So I don't know for sure what the person had in mind here, but I'll let the brothers tell you what they think. What do you think of pre-dating?
I don't think anything of it. In fact, the whole concept of dating, in some ways troubles me. And if you're going to ask me why it troubles me, you know, probably my old-fashionedness will just simply come out, but I do not at the same time believe that it has to be me. You know, I have three sons, they're all married. And I'm thankful that they all have godly wives, and I appreciate that. Did I help them at all? I did not go scouting and say, there's the one. Get that one. But I did give them some counsel. But I do ask you, what would be wrong with that? What would really be wrong with that? Is there anything inherently wrong with that principle? I don't think there is. And in some countries, that's the way it is. Having said that, now that I have your attention, I question whether predating is a legitimate concept, because it suggests that while we're not old enough to get married, and probably not old enough to be thinking about getting married, we want to think about thinking about it. And so it keeps going down and down and down. And Brother David shared about some things that from other perspective, we say, that just looks so stupid. Let me give you this true story. We have a Bible club at home in our church, and the age is from 5 to 13. One day, and this is a true story, one day two girls were sitting together, and they were both very somber looking. Now remember the age group, the perimeters. They were sitting there together, and the one was dejected and the other was disgusted. And so I went up to him and asked him, what your problem is? And the one said, I'm having a problem with my boyfriend. And the other one said, yeah, he's my ex. That was her words. 13 years old. Were they predating? I don't know. Someone has said that could just be puppy love. And perhaps it is, but to a puppy, it's real. But puppies shouldn't be getting married. And so I don't really think much of predating. I hope I can say that kindly.
I think our biggest problem was just not being totally sure what exactly this practice is. If we're talking about you're too young to date and so you do predating, Joe and I would definitely think that's not a good idea. There's a reason why you wait till you're older. Now, and that may answer the question. I'm trying to figure out exactly what the practice is. Would the person who put the question in, would they care to explain that? If you want to remain anonymous, fine.
I worked with someone that is a horrible habit of doing that. And when asked whether or not they had a girlfriend lately, they would say no. Everyone knows every Saturday he drives 45 minutes to go see this girl. When asked if he's in a relationship, no, I'm not. And I asked my boss that later, I said, well, what do you call this phenomenon? And he didn't really know. And then I asked one of my cousins, they said, oh, they're just predating. Like it was some fad or I don't even know what to call it. But apparently it's a rather interesting thing that young people like to do, have a non-committal relationship with someone that they're attracted to.
Okay. Yeah, if it's, like I say, more of a recreational thing. Now, from the experience here at Shippensburg, where I went for many years, dating here, it generally works that when two people start dating, they almost always get married. I mean, it's such that, you know, when I hear so-and-so is dating somebody or courting them, it's, you know, I can only think of one that I know of where he got broken off, you know. Now, in that setting, I would say it might be good to have activities where people can get to know each other a little bit. You know, in dating, I'm glad dating is as serious as it is at Shippensburg. I mean, I'm not saying that in any critical thing. I've just wondered, wow, are these people just... because they happen to ask, this person asked you, that's it, now you're getting married, you know, and maybe you're not the best for each other. I don't know, you know. So if the question means, you know, should there be some way for young people, and of course, you might think this is predating, having a Bible school. I mean, I don't know what the word, you know, neither one of us had ever heard of the word, you know. So if it's a matter of, you know, ways for young people to get to know the opposite sex in a wholesome environment, then I think that's good that you know each other and know where your heart's at. I mean, there are some situations that I've, you know, become aware of, you know, people in plain circles getting married and they obviously did not know the other spouse very well. And, you know, now the spouse has left and stuff like that, and someone has just messed up their life, permanently. And I don't know all of the circumstances, but, you know, they either didn't know that person very well, or they wanted to date somebody who was on the edge, who was trying to be cool and all of that. And, you know, they find out the hard way that doesn't make a good husband or wife, that kind of person, you know. So I don't know, but I would say make sure you really know the person well, and that just because you start dating that you shouldn't feel like, okay, now we have to go through and get engaged and get married. But okay. Yeah, you're going to say something, Betsy? You can explain it. Yeah, if it's because you're too young, I don't think it's real wise, or because, you know, you're not supposed to be, you know, doing it. Again, getting to know somebody is one thing, but yeah, you know, in other words, if you're too young, you're too young. You shouldn't, you know, find some way to get around that. It's for your own good. I mean, if your church has either a tradition or a standard on that, I guarantee you it is for your own good. I mean, particularly when you get outside of plain circles, I cannot believe how many people have totally messed their life up. And they're only 19 or something, you know. They're already divorced and remarried or something. I mean, my heart goes out to them, you know. But hopefully that wouldn't ever happen in our circles. Well, certainly we wouldn't have remarriage. But, I mean, be glad you wait. And don't think our traditions are strict. A number of years ago, a brother from India visited here at Shippensburg. Sorry, Joe, I get a dry mouth. And I forget how dating came up, but after the service, he was telling me he was just shocked that we allowed young people to date and all that, and how ungodly that was and everything else. Because in India, you don't, you know, even non-Christians would not date, you know, and your family picks out a spouse for you. And I'm not necessarily in favor of that either, but I'm saying just don't think that if your church has a similar practice as Shippensburg, that the church is being too strict. I mean, because, what we practice here that I'm aware of is, like I say, a lot more liberal than what would have been allowed in times past. So, yeah, predating sounds like, wow, you're trying to push the boundaries again.
With all the what was being talked about here, I well remember in the setting we came from previous to being here, now that I understand a little bit more what predating is, there was quite a number of couples that did that. And I don't know if any of those couples are together today. They might be, but I was just trying to quickly think of them. But I know a number of them, very, very quickly, two of them that are now divorced and separated and all of that. Because I can remember of those situations where they, you know, were too young to get married, and yet they were messing around. So, yeah. Brother Lynn always said, I think he had a message on, I don't know if it was marriage or whatever, he always said, you should be old enough to get married when you start to date. Because that's the reason why you should be dating, is to get to know the person to marry them. Now, I'm not saying that you have to marry the first person you date, but I'm saying you should be old enough to be, you know, to take on the responsibilities of marriage whenever you begin to take on, you know, to court or date, whatever word you want to use there. Okay. We have time for this one, I think. If a Christian woman is asked by her non-Christian husband to stop covering her head Should she continue wearing it because we should obey God rather than man, or discontinue wearing it to honor or be submissive to her husband?
I can appreciate there might be more than one opinion on this. I guess, you know, my view on that, and I actually have seen it a number of times in real life when you're dealing in a church where you have a lot of seekers, that does come up. The head covering is being worn to show you're submissive to your husband, and it always seemed ironic to me, you know, I'm going to wear this to show I'm submissive to my husband, even though my husband doesn't want me to wear it. I can understand at the same time the other principle, we look to God as ruler rather than men. And this would be my own counsel on it. The commandment in 1 Corinthians 11 says when a woman is praying or prophesying. Now, it is a tradition that goes back to the early church of women, Christian women, wearing a covering at all times. So we're not, you know, we're not doing something that's strange or anything like that. But since the actual commandment is only when you're praying or prophesying, and I'm assuming we're talking about normally when a woman is praying, I don't think there's going to be very many husbands who object to that. A covering doesn't have to be like what we plain people wear. There's many ways to cover your head, a scarf, things like that in our congregations, we would have a standard. Yes, we maybe don't want our sisters covering their heads that way. But again, when you're coming from another background, and if your husband, and I would say most husbands would object. When you're not in a plain setting, I mean, you know, it's just, for my wife and I mean, she's been covering since the 80s. I mean, it's second nature. We hardly even think about it. But I remember, you know, people when I was in Texas, you know, not around plain people, and you know, when my wife first started, it's like, what on earth is this? Weird? Are you guys in a cult? What's happening? You know, it does look very strange to other people, and it's very, I think, could be expected that if your husband's an unbeliever, that he is not going to be comfortable with this because it does affect him as well. So my thought was, obey what God says. When you come to church, cover your head. I don't think he's going to have any objection if you're coming to a plain church or another. If you pray at home, you know, put on a scarf when you pray. I don't think that's what he's normally going to be objecting to. It is putting on a veil or a cap like what we wear and wearing it all of the time. And you can't really say, well, God commanded me to do that. Because, you know, you're saying I'm wearing this to show I'm submissive to my husband, but on the other hand, I'm rebelling against what my husband says. So that would be my thought, where you could, you know, follow what Scripture says and still be pleasing to your husband. And I'd say the same, it also comes up on modest dress. You know, most unbelieving husbands are not going to object to a modest dress. They're going to object to a cape dress like what we wear. But you can dress modestly other ways. I'm not saying anything about standards in our churches. I'm just saying when you're in that situation, when I hear of a husband divorce his wife because she started dressing modestly, I don't think so. You know, if dressing modestly was the only thing, it's when you just decide, okay, I'm going to be the spiritual head and I'm going to go this way, and you're doing things that God doesn't require as a way to just basically take over the spiritual headship of your home. So I would say truly submit to your husband, but yeah, you can obey God at the same time by putting on a scarf or whatever would be appropriate when you are praying.
It is a tough situation, and one that certainly my heart would go out to anyone in that particular situation. I do believe that husband, unbeliever or not, is still her head. He is still her authority. And if he would ask her, and I agree with what was shared as far as the perimeters of this, but if he would ask her, look, I'm embarrassed to be around you when we go to Walmart or wherever. I want you to quit wearing it. That accountability now rests with the husband. She is to be submissive to him, and it doesn't seem congruent for her to say, I am in submission to you, but take off that sign of submission. It's a tough situation, but I do believe that the right thing for that Christian woman to do would be to concede to the wishes of her husband and see what the perimeters are in reference to whether or not she can pray by her bedside or wherever and have something on her head. God understands. God is not capricious. He understands that situation, but he will require, I'm convinced, something of that husband on the day of judgment. To the rest of you, I would simply say, especially on the heels of the question we just had before, that's what courtship is all about, so that there are not those kind of surprises. And yet I know those things happen. I understand that those things happen. We had a situation like that in Tennessee when we lived there years ago. Today there's nothing there. They've thrown everything away. And so it was just a whim at that point. But I do believe that God is going to hold that man responsible for where his girls and his wife is today. Pretty sobering as I think about it.
Okay. Our time's here. Thank you again for all those questions. I appreciate it. Appreciate your questions, and the box is still there to put some more in.
Again, it really helped us getting these in advance where, you know, Joe and I could talk together and give some thought to them. Great questions you're asking. Yeah, if you can just, even if you put it in the morning or even during the lunch hour, where we have a little bit of time to think on it, it's a blessing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, be back here at 2:45 for music.